This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We asked our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, to tell us about some of the box sets that came out this year. You still have some time to consider them as holiday gifts, and you have plenty of time if you want to add them to your own collection. Kevin, happy holidays. You've said there are a lot of really good jazz box sets this year, more than you can remember?
Yeah, it's really true. There's just so many of them, and you know, a lot more than we'll be able to discuss today. And there's something for every budget, so you know, hang in there if we start with the more expensive ones. I guess the first one I'd mention, which I reviewed on the show a few shows ago, is the Fat Albert Eiler box on Revenant. That's what every free jazz fan will be writing to Santa for this year. Blue Note has a compact 4-CD retrospective of organist Jimmy Smith, who really set the standard for jazz organ playing in the 1950s and 60s. He's been so imitated, it's kind of hard to hear him for himself at this point. But it's still really a thrill when he pulls out the stops and makes that big electric console dance.
You want to play something from it for us?
Yeah, why don't we listen to a little of his version of Thelonious Monk's Hackensack from 1958.
Sounds really good, although it's always so surprising to me to hear somebody as like verbose as Jimmy Smith playing something as spare as Thelonious Monk's work. But how about another box set?
Yeah, all right. Well, this season there's another of Columbia's lavish Miles Davis boxes. And Seven Steps to Heaven, which is on seven CDs, naturally enough, is like the first reel of one of those Seven Samurai knockoffs where the boss assembles the classic squad one by one. In this case, the classic squad would be Miles's mid-60s quintet with Herbie Hancock and Tony Williams. The set begins early in 1963 when Ron Carter joins on bass, and it ends a year and a half later just after Wayne Shorter comes in on tenor saxophone. It's mostly live versions of Miles' favorites that he recorded over and over in that period, but his lip is in great shape, as it wasn't always, and there's a terrific Tokyo concert with Sam Rivers on tenor, who plays like he'd never get this chance again, which he didn't. But it's no match for the recordings just ahead when Shorter really settles into the band.
What do you think is the best of the boxes this year?
I think the big box in every sense for me is the complete prestige recordings of Dexter Gordon. That's on 11 CDs and mostly recorded between 1969 and 73.
Isn't that period sometimes described as a low point for mainstream jazz? And isn't Dexter Gordon often given as an example of a neglected master of the period?
Oh, yeah, that old story, that Dexter moved to Europe because the Beatles had wiped jazz out and he stayed in exile until he was rediscovered in 1976. It's a good story, except the facts kind of get in the way. Gordon moved to Europe before the Beatles hit over here, and between then and his nominal homecoming, he recorded something like 50 albums. Many of them were recorded back in the States when he came over to visit, including a lot of the stuff in this box. Some of it was taped in front of audiences who don't seem to notice that they don't like mainstream jazz anymore because they seem to be having a really good time. You know, his style fit him, and maybe that's part of the reason that he sounds so satisfied here. He was a big, swaggering guy with a big, swaggering sound. He had a knack for being able to talk to people from all walks of life, and his music kind of works the same way. He'd put these really complicated bebop licks side by side with jokey quotes from familiar tunes that anybody could laugh at. Shall we listen to a little?
Sure.
I want to play you a snippet of Dexter Gordon at the Montreux Festival in 1970. This is from Blue Monk, another Monk tune, where he dips into a then-recent pop song, which I challenge you to identify, Terry. But whether you identify it or not, check out how he takes the tune's opening phrase and works it into his improvisation.
Okay, I think I lose this round. At first, I thought he was improvising on Moody's Mood for Love or I'm in the Mood for Love, and then I thought, nah. Then it started to sound like St. Louis Blues, which I can't even imagine him playing. So I think I lose this round, Kevin. What was it?
It was Georgie Fame's The Ballad of Bonnie and Clyde from 1967.
Oh, come on. Sure, I was supposed to know that? These questions are too tough.
Well, I got it.
Oh, all right. Is that from the soundtrack?
From the soundtrack of the movie Bonnie and Clyde? No, but it was certainly a tie-in to the popularity of the film. That was a kind of a trend in the 60s where you'd take Burt Bacharach used to write these songs like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance that didn't come from the movie but were clearly tied into the release of a film.
They're called exploitation songs.
Good to know.
Yes.
And rightly so. You know, Dexter Gordon sort of invented the bebop tenor sax in the 1940s, and he helped popularize that brash and greasy saxophone sound. He also had this playful sense of competition, and in the prestige box, he dukes it out with fellow tenors like his original sparring partner, Wardell Gray. That's from a track from 1950. Plus James Moody, Gene Ammons, and the great Texas tenor, Booker Irvin. There are so many good players in this box, and the pianists alone include Jackie Byard, Barry Harris, Bobby Timmons, and Hampton Hawes, who mostly plays electric piano to remind us that jazz did have its downside in the 1970s.
My guest is Fresh Air jazz critic Kevin Whitehead. We'll hear more good music after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air jazz critic Kevin Whitehead. We're talking about recent CD box sets that could make good holiday gifts. Let's move on to some bargains.
Okay. To my mind, if you're going to give music for the holidays, there should be at least a 2-CD minimum. Otherwise, you come across looking a little bit like a cheapskate. So let me recommend The Great Concert of Charles Mingus from Paris in 1964. That's on 2 CDs. It comes from a difficult tour, which is widely documented on other CDs, but this one kind of stands out. The trumpeter got sick and had dropped off the tour, and reed player Eric Dolphy had announced he'd be leaving the band when it was over to remain in Europe. Although no one had an inkling that Dolphy would die of complications of diabetes about 10 weeks later. But despite all the troubles, Dolphy and tenor saxophonist Clifford Jordan really blend well to cover for the missing trumpet. And pianist Jackie Byard could play in any style, and usually did in the course of a concert. And Mingus on bass and Danny Richmond on drums played all sorts of fancy games with the time, so they kind of anchored the band's engaging looseness in a good way. Shall we listen to a little of their pre-postmodern medley of Charlie Parker themes? The band has a nice way of kind of stepping out of and back into swing time on this number.
That sounds great. ¶¶ what to say after hearing that, except that I really love Mingus.
Yeah, I share your enthusiasm there, and Jackie Byard's accompaniment there on piano is really wonderful to listen to.
Well, that sounds like a good bargain. How about another bargain?
Okay, there's also this nice series of two-disc CD and DVD combinations that RCA put out this year, devoted to Duke Ellington and Fats Waller and Artie Shaw and a couple of others. You get to hear their music and then watch their body language in these old soundies and movie clips on the DVD. I want to single out one volume featuring the father of the tenor saxophone, so-called Coleman Hawkins, whose 100th birthday was last month. It's a good sampler. It starts in 1929 and ends in 1956, and it really lets you hear how his tone ripened over time. And, of course, it includes his early classics recorded for RCA, One Hour and Body and Soul. Hawk's Body and Soul belongs in every home, so this could be your chance to get it for somebody. Yeah, something good to listen to while you're looking at the tree.
So how's the DVD with us? How are the DVDs in the series?
The DVDs are great. There's a really lot of interesting stuff in there. There's a hilarious segment in the Artie Shaw CD about how a swing tune is constructed, which is, like I say, hilarious. The problem with the DVDs is that the documentation is really sketchy. The dates are vague, and there's barely any personnel listings. For instance, the Hawkins DVD has a 1958 TV clip where he squares off against his great rival Lester Young on tenor, and the band includes Charlie Shavers on trumpet and Pee Wee Russell on clarinet and Willie the Lion Smith on piano. But the booklet doesn't mention any of that. I mean, why keep it a secret?
Yeah, I have the same kind of frustration with some CD booklets that don't tell you enough about when it was recorded and who's on a session. Well, Kevin, do you have any surprises for us?
Yeah, check out this golden oldie.
The Lonesome Boy Blue. Oh, nobody's a long time. Nowhere's a big pocket to put little pieces of nice things that have never really happened to anyone except those people who were lucky enough not to get born. Oh, lonesome's a bad place to get crowded into with only yourself, riding back and forth on a blind white horse along an empty road.
So, Kevin, who is that?
It's the poet Kenneth Patchen from the CD Kenneth Patchen Reads with Jazz in Canada, recorded in 1959 with the Vancouver beatnik Al Neals Combo. That's an old Folkways recording that's back out on the little Chicago label Locust Music. Oddly enough, there are two CDs this season documenting the beatnik-era craze for live jazz and poetry, and together they'd make a nice gift for the literary or literate jazz fan.
So this is like a put-it-together-yourself box.
show a little initiative, get out that rubber band. The other CD that goes with it so well is Jazz from the Cellar, with Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Kenneth Rexroth reading in front of improvising musicians in San Francisco.
That sounded great. Now, you're teaching English now, Kevin, so what's your professional opinion of these like poetry jazz records?
Oh, how to be tactful. Well, you sense the poet's elation at connecting with another vibrant contemporary art form, certainly. And Rexroth really gets into lashing out at mass culture standard bearers like Time magazine. But the topical references can sound a little dated, as topical references often do. Well, let's hear some of that Rexroth to make the point.
You killed him, benign lady on the postage stamp. He was found dead at a liberal weekly luncheon. He was found dead on the cutting room floor. He was found dead at a Time policy conference. The editor killed him with a telegram to the Pope. Mademoiselle strangled him with a padded brassiere. Old Possum sprinkled him with a T-ball. After the wolves were done, the vadicides crawled off with his bowels to their classrooms and quarterlies.
Kevin, listening to that, I have to confess, I was laughing.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I mean, it's like scathing in a quaint way, you know. Stick it to those readers of Mademoiselle, you know, come on. But you do get a sense that poetry really mattered then, maybe more than it does now.
Well, while we're talking about poetry and jazz, are there any jazz books that you've enjoyed this season?
Yeah, two really stand out for me. One is a new collection of reviews and essays by the critic Larry Cart called Jazz in Search of Itself. As with all such collections of occasional pieces, some of it is too ephemeral to matter, but he really writes enviably well, and he's really discerning on a wide variety of topics. He gives you everything from a close reading of Hoagy Carmichael's song Lazy Bones to a really good account of how a composer and pianist Herbie Nichols would manipulate chords in such a way you could never quite be sure where he was headed. Cart is also really good at pinpointing the shortcomings of those jazz greats who might leave you or me a little cold, like Bill Evans or Oscar Peterson. Shall I read a little bit of a concert review of Oscar Peterson in 1982 that Larry Cart wrote?
Yeah, I'd like to hear it.
When Peterson shifts into high gear, which is where he likes to be, I hear little more than a series of hammered-out riffs, the kind of brief, streamlined phrases that were so rhythmically intoxicating in the hands of the 1930s Basie band or guitarist Charlie Christian. But riffs are seldom interesting in themselves. Instead, they are the musical equivalent of iron filings, meaningful only when they are shaped into larger designs by the magnetic force of swing. Yet you won't find much design in Peterson's music. Gobbling up the tune, the keyboard, and the listener's ear and nerves, his riffs come at you like a pool of piranhas, an assault so compulsive that your only choices are escape or surrender. You know, Terry, I pride myself on my good figures of speech, but that iron filings line is really good.
Yeah, that's very good. Is there another book you'd like to recommend?
There is, and one I confess I'm just beginning to make headway in, which is musician and Cuban music authority Ned Sublett's Cuba and Its Music, From the First Drums to the Mambo. This is a whopping 600-page tome that begins in Spain in 760 B.C., I spent a lot of time paging through it, and it's full of fascinating stuff that really changes the way you look at music in the New World. He writes about how the slaves who came to North America and to Cuba originated in different parts of West Africa, which helps explain the huge differences between Cuban and North American music. Ned Sublett always digs a little bit deeper than other scholars tend to, looking for profound connections and telling details that alter the big picture. It's really good.
Well, that sounds great. Kevin, happy holidays.
Right back at you.
Kevin Whitehead is Fresh Air's jazz critic. He teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com.